What's up, everybody, and welcome to the best gaming podcast ever, brought to you by GameRanks.com. You're listening to Happiness is Hard to Obtain by RPG Escape Artist. I'm Jacob, and let me introduce the cast. Josh.
Hello.
Ian.
Hey, what's up?
Annie.
Hello.
And Dennis.
Hey.
How's everybody doing this week?
Good.
Pretty good.
Very good, actually. Yeah.
Excellent. I have to be the best.
Man, I haven't been on the cast in like 2 weeks now. I'm going into withdrawals.
Yeah, me neither.
You neither? You mean you too?
No, I haven't been on the cast either.
Oh, well, none of us have been on the cast.
Well, the viewers don't know that. It's all lined up.
Oh, touche, Dennis. Anyways, we're going to go into our news here. We're going to talk about Double Fine and their Kickstarter project. We'll talk about Guild Wars 2, world versus world content. And we're also going to talk about how EA is sending copies of Mass Effect 3 into space.
I'm sorry. I'm going to laugh every time you say that.
EA sending copies of Mass Effect 3 into space.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll just go ahead and start off with that one. Josh, I know you probably have some interesting thoughts, so I'll hand it off to you.
I just think it's a little ridiculous. I'm hoping that no dolphins choke to death on Mass Effect 3.
Oh, they will. You know, they're not smart animals.
Why are they doing this?
They choke themselves with bottle, you know, those rubber polystyrene tin can straps, you know.
Yeah, the six-pack container.
Yeah,
plastic six-pack.
Yeah, they die of that because they don't open their mouths wide enough or something.
Well, anyway,
why are they doing this?
Yeah.
To elaborate just a little bit, you're going to be able to get these next week. And they say that the copies will be falling over New York, San Francisco, Las Vegas, Berlin, London, and Paris.
Yeah, but they're not really in space. They're going to the stratosphere. Like
weather
40,
balloons.
Weather balloons.
Yeah, weather balloons. And I'm sure a few copies will end up, you know, in unestimated areas, but...
Yeah, like the ocean. I'm kind of hoping all of them land in the ocean.
Well, what are they using to launch them?
Weather balloons.
Okay, I mean, but, you know, weather balloons have a lot of variation in the...
That's what I'm saying. Like, this is not very smart.
I don't think they thought about it.
They have GPS tracking so that you can get to them, obviously. And if you get there first, you'll get an early copy. But what's going to happen is it's going to land on private property. Somebody's going to break and enter to get a copy of the game. And then there's probably going to be like a crowd of people somewhere, and they're going to fight over it, and then who gets it then? It's just, it's so poorly thought out.
Not to mention, like, you know, this world, the vast majority of... the physical makeup of the surface of our planet, it's like only a certain chunk of it is inhabited by people because of the whole, you know, ocean thing. And then,
that was a really convoluted way to say that the ocean exists.
Yeah, no, right? Or like we see the newspaper headlines, man falls off Big Ben trying to get the copy of Mass Effect 3 from the clock.
Like, I'm going to be curious to find out what their success rate is with the copies being successfully retrieved.
I know.
Or, like, you know, they could potentially fall in totally uninhabited places, like you guys were saying, private property. Or wouldn't it just be the worst, if it lands in some place where the people are like, what is this?
Yeah.
They have- could turn it into a cargo cult, okay?
I mean, it could be another The Gods Must Be Crazy.
Well, because...
Like I said, a cargo cult, you know, people will start worshipping Shepard, you know, they'll be like, all hail Commander Shepard, you know, he's a god from space.
Alright, well, you know, because you'll be able to get early copies from this, and there'll obviously be a little bit of value that'll be ascertained from being early, I'm gonna make a Discovery Channel show called Hunting Mass Effect 3. And I'm just going to go try find copies of Mass Effect 3 that have fallen from the stratosphere.
And then you can sell them, probably. Make a profit.
What platforms, I mean, are they doing an equal amount for each? I mean, wouldn't it be just shit if you like actually found one and then you're like, well, but fuck.
Searching for the Holy Grail, the PC version. That's the main goal for the show. PS3
I don't know
copies
about
are worth
Grail.
A little bit
I mean,
less.
You have to use Origin after all. Hi-yo!
All right, well, anything else, guys, you want to talk about before we move on to our Double Fine news?
EA's stupid. That's my closing comment.
No, it's a cool idea. I just think that they didn't... You know, when it's executed, it's not going to go very well.
Think right. about EA. They have a marketing budget and they have to use all of it. That's just how it works. So, no, it's true. Like in 2000, the Hellgate London community thing, and they spent $50,000 flying us all there to San Francisco. $50,000 was used to buy computer parts for us. Like we had top of the line quad core Intels. Back then, they weren't even available in the market. You know, they use all that money because that is their budget for PR. So this, I think, is the same thing. They're like, oh, okay, we got $2 million. What do we do with it? You know? And the goal is to spend all of it. There's no way to keep any of it. It's just like government budgets. You have to spend all of it, even if it means doing really stupid shit. So that's my take.
Like to imagine that somebody accidentally ordered a large box of weather balloons at EA. And they're like, oh, what are we going to do with these now?
I guess we could give them to our kids or
games into space.
All right, well, next up on our news reel here is Double Fine and their Kickstarter project. I know that this is about a week and a half old, but we can give you guys an update. They have acquired $1.9 million out of their $400,000 goal towards their adventure project. That is ridiculous. What do you guys think?
Oh, a lot of people want to see them make an adventure game, you know, and rightfully so.
Yeah, I was talking with our good friend Kyle, and he said he would not want any other person except for Tim Schafer to be undergoing this project. He says he loves Tim Schafer.
Well, now they have Ron Gilbert is working with Double Fine too, so they have both of the people who wrote the first two Monkey Island games there. There's no way this is going to be a bad game.
The Monkey Island games are classic too. Like, those are timeless.
Yeah, if this game is not perfect, I will eat my pants on air. This is how confident I am that the game will be amazing.
But like,
will we know that you're actually eating your pants though?
He'll do it on air.
Yeah, I'll film it and you can watch.
Put it up on YouTube.
Now I kind of hope this is a flop.
Yeah, me too.
We're gonna be chocolate pants.
Back to the funding. Like, if you guys look at this, that's like four times what they were asking for. And by the time this month's over, which is their ending time for the project on Kickstarter, they're gonna have so much more money than this. I mean, probably like $3 million, I'm guessing. So they could make like a AAA title almost with that much money, but how are they going to like put it all into one little title like they were expecting to in the first place? Like, do you think they're going to hire more staff or do you think they're just going to try and put in more hours?
Well, they already said that they weren't planning to add voice acting or multi-platform support. So they came out and said that now there's going to be voice acting and they're going to put Mac and Linux and PC and Android. So, I guess they're trying to figure out ways to use all the money. But it's kind of like Ian said about EA. They have to spend it all.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. And I think a lot of it will probably go to marketing around the time it comes out, you know?
That's true as well. I mean, you usually don't think about that as money that you need to make a game, but it would really help them, probably.
Well, like I've said many times before, you know, I think marketing really made Halo 3. I mean, it was a good game, but the marketing blitz that came with it was crazy.
They could always make a sequel.
That's true.
Just make two games for the price of one?
Yeah. Yeah, or even two sequels, you know, and maybe a sequel documentary, or maybe they could make 10 documentaries. It's like 100.
They just start making documentaries to use up the money. It's just like a documentary about Tim Schafer cooking breakfast.
Yep. I'd watch it.
They could follow suit.
My name's Tim Schafer, and over the course of this making breakfast, I've made $30,000.
I should just follow suit with EA since I have all that left over. Send multiple times to space.
They should send Tim Schafer into space with weather balloon.
There you go.
I'm going to enjoy these scrambled eggs with Bobby Kotick and make another $30,000 while I eat them.
Oh, gracious. I just think it's... I was just going to add that I think it's really cool that they have, you know, specifically set aside the funds to provide, you know, porting to all existing platforms. I mean, from what it sounds like, they've left nothing out. And, you know, because it's really frustrating when you get excited about something and you find out that it's going to be exclusive, or it's excluding, like, the one thing that you happen to have, or, you know, you won't be able to play the best version of it or whatever, like, because they just didn't have enough budget to do a very good port of it, or they're just canning it all together or whatever. So, you know, I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
I think that will come back to them, you know, in a very good way.
It's guaranteed.
That's maybe the one thing that kind of does... It's interesting to me about funding a project like that through Kickstarter for them, because what happens if they make absurd amounts of money on what was essentially something that you invested in, and all you get back is the game, basically.
Right, definitely. But, you want to move on to our next news piece, guys?
Sure, yeah.
Awesome.
Sure. Yeah.
Our good friend here, Josh Harmon, wrote up a news post on GameRanks today, talking about Guild Wars 2, world versus world game type. I'll put you on the spot here for a second time, Josh. Why don't you fill us in some?
Okay, so world versus world, or WVW, which is so much easier to say, not really. It's a new PvP game type that basically puts entire servers in massive combat, like 1,200 people, 400 people from three different servers fighting on four different maps that are at the size limit for Guild Wars 2. They can't make maps any bigger than they're putting in this game mode. And you're fighting over these different objectives. There's like small, medium, and large ones, but the biggest ones are giant castles, and your entire team basically has to come in and help you and use these siege weapons to break down the walls, and it just sounds crazy. Like, they haven't released any footage of it. It's just this news post that went up on ArenaNet. But it sounds like the coolest thing that you've ever heard about in any MMO ever.
Sounds like World of Warcraft Battlegrounds.
Better than that, because World of Warcraft Battlegrounds is like 64 people per side.
I know, I'm just saying in terms of like the siege stuff, the gameplay elements. It sounds like the Battlegrounds.
It also sounds like Warhammer Online, which has siege weapons, like, I mean, proper siege weapons. You break down the door, you climb up the stairs, you kill the Lord. But, of course, those are very small, limited affairs. I mean, there's, like, maybe 200 people on both sides.
Right.
Yeah, so here, it's like, whoa, you know, you got three actual armies, 400 people each. That's, a sizable amount of people. It's like a medieval army. You know, it's not like they had 10,000 soldiers back then.
Right, but, like... The only thing I think about when I hear, like, when we have these huge numbers of people fighting in one area, it's never what you expect when the game actually comes out. And I think the perfect example of this would be MAG, which came out to reviews that were, like, very mediocre. And I'd hate to see a game like Guild Wars 2, which I've been waiting for a very long time, to say the least, be like that, you know? I'd rather they stick to the average, not the average, but... the norm, and make the norm awesome. That's what I really wanted to see with Guild Wars 2, because I really do think that Guild Wars has always been the second best in the MMO space, and to me personally, the first. So I really want Guild Wars 2 to succeed.
I think we all do.
We all do. One thing that's kind of interesting to me, because for combat of that scale, like, it's strange because, you know, usually you think of it like when you have entire armies going up against each other, it's usually like one player controlling an entire army versus a computer versus another, you know, it kind of gets into RTS, like, strategy game territory. And so this is more, it's a much more zoomed in sort of thing. Like each unit of each, or well, each individual of each unit of each army is a single person. Like it's, you know, a human AI essentially. And you would think that would provide a lot of opportunities for people to just grief the shit out of each other for no reason.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's true, but you're not really going to get a lot of accomplished and score points if you're just griefing.
That's true. I mean, the siege weapon, the mechanics, if I'm understanding the mechanics of the siege weapons correctly, like, you can't, no one person can actually have enough of the, you know, materials and supplies on them.
Like, yeah, to, yeah.
So
you have to work together to make siege weapons, so.
Mm-hmm.
It seems, because there's one universal resource, we didn't really talk about this. So you have to set up a supply line for your team, for your server that you're fighting on. And if you don't have any supply, you can't build siege weapons, you can't upgrade your defenses on the structures that you have. So it's going to be really, really important. And you're right, in that regard, both strategically and in that you have to, like, manage your economy, it's a lot like playing an RTS game where you only control one unit, which mm-hmm. is a little bit daunting, just in terms of strategizing with that many people. But I guess what they want it to be is kind of like people putting together raiding parties for PvE or something like that. They just do that, but for this massive PvP event.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how it's going to actually work out. You're right, Jacob. It could turn out like MAG, where there doesn't really feel like you're fighting that many people at once.
Yeah.
But I'm optimistic.
See, definitely. And I was about to say that is, you know, in ArenaNet, they have experience with large-scale multiplayer battles, you know, in a modern or contemporary standpoint. And I think that they could be the team to move this forward.
Yeah.
But do you guys want to move on to our hot topic?
The griefing could be hilarious. It could be like Planet Side, you know, where somebody comes in with a mech and then just kills everybody.
I'm just imagining how painful it would be to get ganked by 100 people working together.
Oh, it happens. You know, Planet Side, some I forget what the ships are called, but they could carry like 32 people in them. And you'd have 32 people in a ship, a flying ship, of course, you know. It would fly over some, you know, the continent, and then would just drop down at a place where people are fighting. And then you have this whole team of people just popping out and killing everything. It's funny. And apparently the sequel is coming out soon.
Well, 1 versus 100, you know, if it was Skulldry and this was World of Warcraft, I'd kill everybody. I'm just saying. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know.
Oh, but the one other thing that's kind of cool that I think we should mention before we move on is if you're playing World versus World, they have a system set up so that it will basically level your character to level 80. So it won't give you new gear, so level 80s will probably still be better than you because they have massive gear that they've gotten. But it makes it a bit more fun and a bit more competitive if you want to drop in.
Actually, I hated that. I hated that when I tried the Old Republic. Just for the reason you mentioned there, when your gear doesn't stack up, it's still the same difference. So why not be that? Why not see your progression through that rank or through that bracket of levels? You know, that was exciting for me, you know, as a player to get the gear, to see myself level up and go through that bracket. And I think that WoW is actually has a winning formula there because, you know, if they just give you all the stats and stuff to be aligned with other players, where's the fun in that, you know?
I mean, it's all about how it works in practice.
Yeah, like, some people don't want to spend, I don't know, 50 hours leveling up their character. They'd rather, you know, just get into the PvP. And, like, in Guild Wars, I mean, I agree with you. I don't like rolling a straight-up level 80 character or something, but...
Right, right.
I can see why a lot of people would, you know, because a lot of people don't want to deal with that. They just want to get to the PvP and play their friends or maybe try out a new build.
I guess we'll see, because the Old Republic touts that system, whereas World of Warcraft touts my favorite system. And we'll see how well the Old Republic does over the coming months and whether or not it can has any staying power. Anyways, for a hot topic, we're going to continue our trend of Double Fine and Kickstarter. And we're going to talk about crowdsourcing. Ian, how about you start us off here?
Crowdsourcing, okay. Based on the success of Double Fine, which, you know, a lot of people are saying it's a fluke. It's Double Fine. You know, people like Tim Schafer and so on. Well, regardless of that, a lot of other companies are looking into it. You have Obsidian, where Chris Avellone, the creator of Planescape Torment, he posted on the forum asking for suggestions, like what games people like to see Obsidian make. And it looks like, you know, Planescape Torment 2 is a possibility. Even though it's completely hypothetical, it looks like people are willing to back it up. And they're not the only ones thinking about it. Also on the list is Brian Fargo. He thinks that people might want to back Wasteland 2. And that post is on Gamma Score right now, I think. And so that too is a possibility. You have other people looking into it as well. CCP, the creators of EVE Online, they have teamed up with White Wolf. I mean, they've teamed up a long time ago, and they're supposed to be making a White Wolf online MMO type game. But they have actually officially said that they want to kickstart their next game because I guess they're having funding problems. I mean, no angel investors
are.
Yeah. No angel investor is going to say, "Oh yeah, I'm going to back this game up, you know. You're taking $5 million." No. That's not going to happen. So,
well, but that's another discussion.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. So
we should maybe back up just slightly and talk about for people who don't understand what crowdsourcing is exactly.
Sure.
Because you know, it's basically when you are instead of and it's not just for funding. Sometimes it's for, like, you know, intellectual or academic resources. Like, you have a bunch of people work on a translation, like, just do the parts that you can or whatever. But specifically for fundraising, it's instead of going out and getting a few venture capitalists to back your thing, it's turning it over to the people who would probably be consuming it or are just friends or want to, you know, they have probably some connection to it, or maybe they're just nice people, and they ask everybody to give a little instead of a few people to give a lot. And I think that this is not necessarily a new thing, because it has its roots in things like public television station pledges, drives, and that sort of thing, in combination with the idea of, like, fans choose the next thing, types of situations. And the thing that is really cool about this, though, is that I think that when it's applied to fundraising for video game companies, particularly with indie companies that have already been doing pretty offbeat things, this could really revolutionize the types of titles that we're seeing, because some of the you know, some of the stuff, the IP that a lot of the really big houses are putting out is so tired, and they just keep making it and making it and making it, and it keeps flopping, and they keep making it anyway, and it just seems like such a huge waste of time. Like, I think if nothing else, this is really going to reveal a lot about what people want, you know, what kind of games they really want to play.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that time and time again, we've seen the gaming community rise up and support, you know, indie titles and stuff. And this latest thing with Kickstarter and Double Fine is just a great example of that. But to be able to more publicize that and have more people be involved, I think that we'll see even more, like you're saying.
Yeah, because this makes it so that, you know, it's not just the people with the most money, that which are the few. I mean, you know, it's almost kind of like a parallel for, you know, certain economic observations that are happening in various places in the world right now. Like, it's giving power to people that don't have a lot of money, but like their vote still can count this way, as opposed
it's
to
like
just
a true democracy.
Yes.
It also, on top of that, I mean, like, usually normally when you make a game or a movie or a book or something, you're beholden to the person who's giving you the money. You know, they control the marketing, they're the publishers and so on. But here it's like, okay, you know, because it's crowdfunded, all the creative control remains hands of the creator. You know, the creator doesn't have to say, I have to, you know, listen to marketing. It, like, marketing is like, oh, you need to put more boobs in the game. Right?
Right.
And yeah, and they
no,
don't have to listen to
be
idiots.
Saying, put more boobs in the game.
They all have, you know, in-house. So I think, yeah, it'll probably stay truer to the, you know, original vision of the people who are creating it, like, from the get-go. I think you're right on there, because when it comes time to do marketing, I mean, well, one side effect that's nice is that you already have a huge amount of viral marketing in place already, just by virtue of the fact that everyone is going to be, like, every single person who contributes to your campaign on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or Crowdflower or, you know, any of these places, like, you give them updates and they automatically hear about, you know, which part you're working on and stuff like that. And so that is already huge in terms of marketing. But
oh, go ahead, Annie.
I was just going to say the other side of that is that you no longer have to try to get publishers to pick up your stuff and all that. Like, if you're like, oh, we need to add two more people to the marketing, our in-house marketing team, and so you can choose the two people and sort of suss them out and see that they share your understanding of your own creative work. Like, they're not going to try to, you know, try to, like, mush it into some mold in order to sell it.
Right. Yeah, that goes back to what Josh was saying just a few minutes ago about how, you know, what we're seeing lately is so tired and overused. And it's not just in sequels. You know, it seems like the industry is like that lately. We're seeing the same things, the same gameplay elements in games as other games, and the same as the sequels. And that's really frustrating, because some of the innovation we saw last console generation has been way more astronomically different than many things we've seen this generation. And that's a bold statement, but I believe it's true.
It's like Planescape Torment.
What I'm actually interested in here is, theoretically, because if they do it like Double Fine, where you get a copy of the game if you donate a very, very small amount, basically, theoretically, they know that they're going to sell that many copies. Like, these are pre-orders for a game that hasn't come out yet, effectively.
Guaranteed. Yeah.
So, at that point, they know how little money they have to spend to break even. So if everybody did this, in theory, nobody would ever lose money on a game they made, because if nobody supported it in advance, then they would know they weren't going to move that many copies. But with Double Fine, if they stay under that budget, then they know they're going to break even, and any copies they sell on top of the ones they've already pre-ordered / had people invest in, then that's just pure profit. And when so few games in the modern game market are actually turning a profit, like, it's a very, very small percentage. And yes, that includes shovelware and all that stuff. But there are a lot of really high-profile games that don't turn a profit.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of that, certainly not all of it, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, there's the actual, you know, dev studio, and then there's the, like, marketing team that represents the game, and a different marketing team that represents the studio at all these different events, and there's a publisher, and, you know, everybody's taking a little cut of it. And you know, so yeah, you are kind of lucky to break even with all of that. I think this new model is, like I said, I think it's just really revolutionary, and it'll be interesting to see if it catches on or if there's kind of a backlash from some of the larger publishers, because I can see why there would be. You know, we fear change seems to be, which is kind of I don't know if that's textbook ironic or not, because almost nothing ever is anymore, but, you know, that considering that this is technology, you'd think that people would be more inclined to embrace that sort of thing, but...
I think that in a perfect world, we could see Double Fine and other developers do this over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But that's just not going to happen, I don't think. Like, I think that this trend may continue for another couple games, and then this will kind of die down. I see this as kind of a fad, and I know that's probably being pretty close to the precipice, but, you know, that's just how I see it, and I don't think that there's going to be this overwhelming support that we've seen for Double Fine, mainly because Double Fine has been the first mainstream sort of studio to break through the mold on this type of thing.
Yeah, and as far as mainstream studios go, they're not that mainstream. And Jacob, I really hope you're wrong, because this project, just the nature of it and what it sort of indicates about, you know, just kind of transparency and everything and
opening. I hope I'm wrong too. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm just saying.
But I suspect that you're probably right. Unfortunately.
I disagree.
I think he's right too. Just because when I think about this, it kind of reminds me of the Humble Bundle when that came out and how awesome it was. Because the money's going straight to the developers, and now everybody has bundle fatigue because there's so many.
Yeah, but it's still
clones.
They're still selling though. They're like $2 million for the latest Humble Bundle. So I don't think it's dying down. It's a reason why. You know, everybody's releasing these Humble Bundles because, like, now you have the Indie Music Bundle. That made, like, $500,000 or something. I just pulled that number out of my ass. Don't quote me. I just know it made a lot of money.
Right now.
It made enough money that a month later they released the Indie Music Bundle number 2. You know? So, I think it's going to go on for quite a long time, maybe even forever, because, I mean, you think that, like, Jacob, you said that, that the first studio to do it was Double Fine. No, actually, the first studio to do it was Minecraft. Mojang. Like, when,
No, you get me a little bit wrong here. When you look at Minecraft, that's a studio, and, well, I say studio, but really, it's just a few people. But you look at that, and they weren't very known in the community. Tim Schafer's well known. I mean, he's come out with many titles before this. And correct me if I'm wrong, but how many big things has Notch done, really, you know?
One.
Exactly. So that's where I'm coming from in this. So don't get me wrong.
You're right. But what I'm saying is that the way that the game was promoted, like the Minecraft, before it went, you know, retail, it was actually sold as, you know, you pay now, you pay $10 now, you get into the idea. And that's what he did. He basically crowdfunded his game for 2 years until it was released. And the same thing was actually done by the Frozen Synapse people. They did the same thing. They took pre-orders. Not really pre-order, more like crowdfunding. You know, $10, you pay now, you get 2 copies and the game is out. They did the same thing. And they're not the only studios to do it. Like, the smaller indie studios have actually been doing this for quite a while. It's been successful. I mean, they only managed to get, like, maybe $50,000. But it's enough to pay for, you know, these really small companies in these small studios. Like, I think most recently, Dear Esther, it took pre-orders, and the pre-orders were, like, they amounted to, like, $15,000 or something, and they actually managed to pay off the whole development with the whole thing. So it might not, you know, you might not see successes as big as Double Fine's, because, I mean, Double Fine is a big company, and they did manage to raise over $1 million. But I still see smaller indie studios raising $50,000, $100,000, you know?
When I was saying that, I was just saying that, that it was the biggest breakthrough that we had seen in support from a community in a long time. And that's not to say that this isn't happening with, like, smaller titles and smaller studios, but I think that Tim Schafer and his studio were, I say this, a step up in terms of what we've seen happen elsewhere.
Definitely.
But we need to get moved on to what we've been playing. So, Annie, how about you start us off?
Well, I haven't had a whole lot of time to play much of anything lately because we have been busy organizing Seattle's first Maker Faire, which is an event that started out in the Bay Area and is expanding across the country now. And I'm the interactive design and games lead. So any Seattle listeners that have projects that they would like to exhibit at Maker Faire, please get a hold of me. Shameless plug. That's right. the only game playing that I've done in the last week was on the current D&D campaign that I'm working on. And my barbarian is getting really close to leveling up again. We've killed 3 of the 5 bosses in the dungeon that we're locked in this dungeon right now, actually. And we just got a cleric, which is good because now we're not all in danger of dying like all the time. And I just got a badass vial of ghost siphon that I'm looking forward to using. So
what does that do?
That
siphons ghosts.
Because we had to fight a ghost, a wizard ghost. A pissed off wizard ghost.
You're a wizard, Harry.
He was not that kind of wizard, dude. He was a nasty wizard.
Like Voldemort.
Yeah, they called him the Splatter Man.
Guys, can I just say something real quick?
Sure.
In terms of you're a wizard, Harry, I went to see Woman in Black. And
oh, yeah.
I was that guy who made Harry Potter jokes the whole movie.
I'm actually going to see that tonight.
The jokes.
Okay.
Anyways, anything else, Annie?
No, I think I'm done.
All right. So, Dennis, how about you go, man? You've been really quiet this podcast, so feel free to take some extra time on what we've been playing.
No, because I'm exactly like Annie. I really didn't have time to play anything. Really, it was just a few hours probably of Skyrim in the past 2 weeks.
Man, old Skyrim. All right, anyways, Ian.
I have been playing Kingdoms of Amalur.
Yeah.
Yes, I have. It's awesome. You know, it's the combat is a lot like Darksiders. It's a lot like God of War. So it's not like your typical RPG, the shitty combat. You know, you can play Skyrim and it's a great game, but combat's so terrible. Well, it's not the case here of Amalur. And despite what a lot of people are saying, they're saying, oh, you know, we're not enthusiastic about the game's background story because it's this new fantasy world and I'm, you know, I can't get into this new fantasy world or whatever.
Let me cut you off for just a second. Why would somebody be unhappy about a new fantasy world? We don't want something recycled.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, a lot of people are... That is the complaint, like, you know... Well, I understand the complaint. If you read a lot of fantasy books, you don't really feel like, you know, picking up a new series. So I understand that part of it. But the thing that that actually draws me into Amalur is that it's actually well-written. They put a lot of effort into... this fantasy world. It's not like some throwaway Dungeon Siege style crappy, poorly written fantasy. You know, Dungeon Siege is pretty shitty if you think about it. But here it's actually, you know, they've got this big history. They've got the Court of Winter and the Court of Summer. Those are the Fae. They're not elves. They're Fae. You know, the fairies. And it's all very intricate. And I find myself pulled into it by all these little stories that they weave around me. Like, it's not... like, when you're playing the game, it's not, oh, kill 5 monsters, move into the next area. You're actually part of this world where things are happening, you're part of it, and the story is, like, you're affecting the story, you know, you're not viewing it from the outside. It doesn't feel like an MMO where you play a game and, you know, the story is just sort of told without you. You could be there, you couldn't be there, it's just told. But no, here you're actually affecting the story, so... It feels to me, Kingdom of Amalur feels to me like you're a protagonist in a fantasy story, like a novel. You're the hero and you're doing things and the story is about you. And that's what I really like about it. Very few games manage to do this. Like Dragon Age 2 told a story without you in it. You know, it just went on by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Amalur is it's very well done, and I might write an article about it in the future.
All right, cool. Anything else, Ian?
No, that's all I've been playing.
All right, Josh. You're up.
I've been playing a lot, so I'm going to keep this short and sweet. In the past week, Sonic Generations, terrible. Just terrible. So disappointing as somebody who loved the old Sonic games. Neither of the two halves of that game are good. They don't work well together, and I was really disappointed. I also played through Shank completely, because I wanted to play Shank 2, and I hadn't played Shank 1 yet. It's a gorgeous game. The visual style is pretty much the best I've seen in a 2D platformer ever, but it was really short. It was like 3 hours long, and it was incredibly repetitive for being 3 hours long. I don't understand what the appeal is. And then I've played through some Space Chem, which is, I think, my new addiction. Buy Space Chem, that's all I'm telling you. It's probably really cheap. It's the best puzzle game you'll ever play. It will make you feel like the stupidest person on the face of the earth. And finally, I've been playing Test Drive Unlimited 2, which is a racing game. It's kind of okay. I have, like, a guilty pleasure thing for mediocre racing games. But I was really upset because apparently on the PC version, you cannot play the game, even in single player, unless you connect to the Atari servers. And they took them down for maintenance for what was supposed to be like 2 hours and wound up being like 2 days. So I had this game in my Steam library that I couldn't play. And it made me very, very angry.
It's shitty.
Yeah. It's my first encounter with like always on DRM, and it's terrible.
People like to bitch about Ubisoft, but at least Ubisoft is prompt. You know, but their downtime, it's like an hour sometimes. And most of the time you don't even notice it because the game does support offline mode. But when other companies do it, nobody complains about it. Why is that?
I just don't think anybody's really playing too many games that use it. Like, I don't think that many people are playing Test Drive Unlimited 2. But a lot of people play Assassin's Creed and all that stuff. It's just a pretty big punching bag for people, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, like EA does it. You know, with Mass Effect 2, you have to have the server's network. It has to be online to play. Otherwise, you can't load your DLCs. The same goes for Dragon Age, Dragon Age 2. I don't see anybody complaining about those. What is up with that? Like,
there was definitely
going
an uproar
all the
about
time.
Mass Effect 2, though. There was an uproar about Mass Effect 2 when that came out. I think people have just started to bend over and take it, honestly.
I think it's because they love BioWare. You can't say anything about BioWare without somebody jumping down your throat and defending it. You know, but
they did win the award for worst community at the 4chan.
4chan.
VGA
Game Awards. Well, I agree with them. I mean, I agree with 4chan in that case because I think it's just the mainstream gamers who are like, there's like this BioWare defense force, so you can't say anything. You can't say, oh, I found Dragon Age 2, the combat really crappy. I found the story bland. You know, like a good number of reviewers have said that very openly, and they always get attacked, you know, myself included. You know, it's like, yeah. But I'm
Josh.
Going off topic. I'm sorry.
Yes. Josh, is there anything else you've been playing?
That's about it. What about you, Jacob? What have you been playing?
Me, I have not had very much time to play video games, but I have had some time with Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, like Ian.
Yep.
And in the weird case of Amalur: Reckoning, it's strange. This is one of those games where it feels retro, even though it's in like a new generation. I don't know how to explain it, but the game isn't so up to date that it has like super refined graphics or anything, but you can sort of fill in the game with your imagination a little bit. Like, for instance, the draw distance in the game, you can't see so far off into the distance that it fills it in for you, but you can sort of imagine what's out there yourself, if you can understand what I'm saying.
It's like World of Warcraft or Fable.
Yes, exactly. Like, unless you have like a computer that can run WoW on the draw distance of like miles and miles away, WoW is like this surreal experience because you fill that in for yourself. And like even right down to the combat, things still feel sort of retro-y even though it's in this new generation. But before I go off on a tangent about Amalur, you can read the full review here probably in the next couple of days. I wish Matt was here because I have been playing a little bit of the demo for UFC Undisputed 3. And I like
it. You keep sending stories about UFC games into my inbox, and I just decide not to write them.
You are terrible. You're supposed to write them.
Ian's like, I'm not going to write this here, Josh.
And then I'm not going to write it. I don't have anybody to send it to.
But, yeah, I'm sure once I get the full copy of the game, I'll talk a little bit more about it. But seeing as I only have the demo right now, I don't want to speak too much about it. But I'm enjoying the demo. And it's
giving
me
a fighting game.
Yeah. And I guess that's it. We'll move on to our giveaway unless anybody else has anything to say.
No.
All right. So we have Circle K gift cards from Open Bucks. Through Open Bucks, gamers can buy and pay for virtual goods inside hundreds of online games using retail gift cards from retailers like Circle K. And without further ado, this has been the best gaming podcast ever.